and prior to that, we talked about principal components analysis. So what I want to do this morning is to talk about a generalization of linear discriminant analysis known as heteroscedastic linear discriminant analysis, and then also talk briefly about another related technique called independent component analysis. So the main things that we'll do today, we'll generalize LDA, we'll discuss this in the context of a maximum likelihood framework, and then with ICA, we'll talk a little bit about information theoretic approaches to these kinds of classification problems, and then we'll work some examples. In terms of the heteroscedastic linear discriminant analysis, this classification example on the right here is going to be sort of the test case that defines when this algorithm works really well. So we'll spend a little bit of time talking about this and actually working an example or two with that kind of data. But so keep that in the back of your mind, the situation where you have two classes that have significant overlap between them. So let's first review what we discussed with linear discriminant analysis. Linear discriminant analysis seeks to find the transformation y is equal to w transpose times x that maximizes the separation between the classes. This is done by maximizing a ratio of the between-class scatter and the within-class scatter. So we define a transformation w, and actually in the case where we had multiple classes, we have a transformation per class, essentially. And then we talked about the different ways that we could find the coefficients for this transformation. In the LDA approach, we maximize the ratio of the between-class scatter and the within-class scatter. So we showed that maximization of an objective function J, which was a ratio of W transpose times S sub B times W divided by W transpose times S sub W times W. S sub B is the between-class scatter, and S sub W is the within-class scatter. And S sub W, if you recall, was just the sum of the scatters of each one of the classes. So S1 plus S2 and so forth out to S sub C. So a good approach for choosing the values of W would be to maximize S sub B, to make the classes as far apart as possible in the transform space, and to also then minimize S sub W again in the transform space to make those class, each of the classes as compact as possible. Now, you might think, well, why are we restricting ourselves to linear transformations if that's our goal? Because you might not be able to both of those things with one linear transformation. And in fact, that's correct, and that's why throughout the semester we will talk about classification techniques that do this kind of transformation in a nonlinear way so that you can achieve both of these sort of independently using much more powerful projection operators. But for the class of linear transforms, linear discriminant analysis represents a good solution to this problem. So the solution to this maximization is found by performing an eigenvalue analysis. We essentially solve the equation S sub B minus lambda sub I times S sub W. The norm of that is equal to zero. The determinant of that, rather, is equal to zero. And the value of W's that produce this solution are what we want, and we talked about how those can be found from looking at the C minus 1 highest eigenvectors of lambda sub I. And that then produces a matrix W that has a dimension 1 less than the number of classes, C minus 1 rows and D columns, because we're essentially projecting into a lower dimensional space. So if we have two classes, W projects onto a line. If we have three classes, onto a hyperplane, and so forth. Now, one thing we didn't sort of elaborate on in this analysis was that there was an implicit assumption when we formed this S sub W that all classes had the same covariance structure. We wrote, for example, that the total covariance is the sum of S sub W plus S sub B. And S sub B was just the covariance of the means of each one of the classes. Now, you can see, so we talked about principal components analysis and we talked about linear discriminant analysis. What was the difference? What was the primary difference between PCA and LDA? Or what was the major weakness of PCA? Or what's the major, I really should say, the major feature of principal components analysis? What aspects does it attempt to model the data? Okay, and in modeling that Gaussian, what aspects does it model and what priority? Tries to find the largest variance, right. So let me go back to that little figure on the first page. So if you have data distributed like this, if we have two classes, one which has a large variance and one which has a smaller variance, and the means overlap, but the variances are different, what is PCA going to do when we try to model this data? Right. The overall covariance of the data is essentially going to be this outer ellipse. And therefore, the principal components analysis does what? Well, the first, it attacks essentially variance. It goes after the direction of greatest variance and the direction of second greatest variance. So the direction of greatest variance here is what? Which direction? Going to this way. So it's going to attack that. And in the process, basically, the differences between these two classes is going to be ignored, because the means overlap and one variance is masked by the other variance. Now, you might be asking, well, why on earth would you want to classify this data in the first place when there's pretty high error rates? And I'll talk about that towards the end of class. There are problems, actually, where we see this pretty regularly. LDA, what does LDA try to do on the other hand? Right. So in this case, there's a number of solutions to that problem, essentially, because the way the data is distributed. But a good LDA solution would be shown here, where we're essentially trying to look in this direction. If we project these distributions onto a line, we get this kind of overlap, and LDA isn't really able to separate them, because the limitations of the projection operation. Now, ideally, what you'd like is a transformation that could sort of take this section of the data, put it in one place in the space, and take this section of the data and put it in another place in the space. And we'll talk about that later in the semester when we get to more powerful techniques. That would be a nonlinear projection. But in this LDA formulation, since the total variance is the sum of the individual variances, what happens if the individual classes have significantly different variance? So let's say, for example, we showed in that previous picture, class 1 has a very large, very dispersed variance or covariance, and class 2 has a smaller, more compact covariance. Well, the S sub W, which is just going to be the sum of the individual class covariances, is going to be dominated by what? By the very large variance. So we still have the multidimensional scaling problem that If one class is significantly different than another class in terms of variance, it could potentially mask the variance of the smaller class. So is there an approach that frees us from this constraint of equal covariances or covariances approximately the same scale? And the answer is yes, because I have something to talk about this morning. So, but it comes at a cost, as we'll see. And the mathematics are not nearly as simple or tractable as with LDA. So let's take a look at that. So heteroscedastic linear discriminant analysis. It's an approach to deal with the situation when random variables have different variances. So it's a technique to try to accommodate a classification problem where each of the individual classes has different variants. You might wonder, well, when might we observe this kind of behavior? Well, one example that's cited. Suppose you have 100 students enroll in a typing class, some of which have typing experience and some of which do not. After the first class, there would be a great deal of dispersion in the number of typing mistakes. The experienced typers would do much better than the inexperienced typers. But after the final class, the dispersion would be smaller because presumably the inexperienced typers have learned. So the error variance in this case is non-constant. It decreases as time increases. And that's not uncommon in many, many pattern recognition problems where you're dealing with humans, for example. Because typically when you subject humans to any kind of a testing scenario, over time they begin to become influenced or biased by the testing scenario. For example, over the weekend I was talking with some colleagues about course evaluations, one of our favorite topics, and the right ways to measure course evaluations and the wrong way to measure course evaluations. And one of the things you find whenever you ask people to do these kinds of judgments is that their judgments over if the evaluation instrument is long, typically if you're doing some kind of detailed survey, it might take you 45 minutes to an hour if you're doing some kind of, I don't know if any of you have ever participated in any of these kinds of evaluations, but years ago, an organization I was with went through one of these quality improvement things, and one of the first steps was to study what was wrong with our workplace. So the psychologist came in and gave us this one-hour survey with lots of different questions, but they didn't just ask us sort of what's wrong with your workplace. What they did instead was they had an instrument to measure this. Well, what you find as people work over that kind of a time period is that your judgments start to shift. Either you're becoming annoyed with the questions or you're just thinking about the questions and answering them slightly differently as time goes on. So what typically is done in these kinds of surveys is you embed questions that allow you to sort of normalize the scores. So if you study the questions that they're asking over the period of about an hour, you will see that some of the questions are asking for the same things periodically throughout the exam. And one of the reasons they do that is so they can actually look at the drift in your scores as a function of time. Because anytime you participate in these kinds of surveys, the way you answered a question at the beginning of the survey is invariably going to be different than the way you answered the question at the end of the survey. So most good survey instruments that you take have these kinds of what are called anchors embedded in them, so that you can then compare your scores on these anchors to other people's scores on these anchors and sort of somehow normalize your scores. So we were discussing this because the course evaluation forms here don't do any of this kind of stuff, which they really should do, but long story about that. But the point is, in any kind of human judgment, you have to deal with the fact that the data you're getting is likely to vary as a function of time, and the data you're getting is likely to have variances which are unequal. Another thing you find in human testing is, in these kinds of surveys, is that there are maybe three types of people in the world. There's very strongly opinionated people, people with no opinions, and then kind of people in the middle. The strongly opinionated people will always give you scores at the extreme. You give them a 5-point scale, you look at their sheet, there'll be ones and fives and not much in between. The weakly opinionated people will use the middle of the scale. And then, you know, there's probably another group somewhere in between. So you can't simply add these scores together because you've got one group with a very large variance. They're always maximizing the scale, and one group with a very small variance. They're always in the middle. So these kinds of examples are really good examples for heteroscedastic linear discriminant analysis. We actually use this in speech, and I'll talk about that in a little bit later. So this example that we want to sort of use as our demonstration today is this case where two classes have nearly the same mean, but different variances, and the variances differ in one direction. Now, again, you might be wondering, why would you even try to classify that data? But let me address that at the end of lecture when I talk about how this is used. Well, I'll explain this in the context of speech recognition system. So LDA would project these classes onto a line that does not achieve maximum separation. And HLDA seeks a transform that will account for the unequal variances. So if HLDA works properly, we'll end up with something like this. And at the very least, then, we can perhaps properly classify the data at the edges of the distribution and get a lower error rate than if we use this projection, we're going to have a very high error rate because we've essentially compressed the areas of the surface where the two classes are different. That information is lost. Right? I hope people can see that. By projecting those two classes onto these overlapping distributions, you've essentially normalized out the variance of the larger class and lost what little discrimination you have. Here, on the other hand, we're going to take an error rate hit where the two classes overlap, but at least we'll correctly classify the data outside of that region. So we'll get a lower error rate, essentially. Not a 0% error rate, but a lower error rate. So HLDA is typically useful when classes have significant overlap. And that is, if you remember some of the examples I put up at the early part of the semester, when you look at features for speech recognition systems, for example, and you plot those features as a function of the sound that's being spoken, you see tremendous overlap in the feature space. Tremendous overlap. And you might wonder, well, how is it that we can do speech recognition when the features have such a high degree of confusability? Well, I'll mention that a little bit at the end of class. So the way we're going to do this is to partition our parameter vector. Let W be partitioned into the first P column corresponding to the dimensions we retain and the remaining D minus P columns corresponding to the dimensions we discard. Then the dimensionality reduction problem can be viewed in two steps. A non-singular transform is applied to X to transform the features. We still want to use a linear transformation-based approach. But the second step is the dimensionality reduction is performed where we reduce the output of this transform to a reduced dimension vector Y sub P. So let us partition the means and variances as follows. We're going to have a mean vector which is partitioned according to the first P dimensions correspond to the dimensions we retain, and the remaining D minus P dimensions correspond to the dimensions that we discard. So we can write the mean vector as a composite of two vectors, the mean vector of the data we retain and the mean vector of the data that we discard. Similarly, we can then write the covariance matrix as a combination of the covariance of the dimensions that we retain and the covariance of the dimensions that we discard. Now, these kinds of transformations that do this type of dimensionality reduction, these are very, very common. If you've seen things like singular value decomposition or even within principal components analysis, we haven't talked extensively about this, but it's very advantageous with PCA to sometimes reduce dimensions and only focus on those dimensions that are meaningful to the problem. So we looked at, we talked about the example of buying a car and what factors might influence your purchase of a car. Well, if you give somebody a survey on that problem, you might come up with 25, 30 different reasons that help explain the choices that people make. However, if your goal then is to sort of develop a business strategy based on this, you're not going to use all 25, 30 dimensions. In fact, you will use, if let's say your goal is to buy 1 minute of Super Bowl time at, you know, whatever, millions of dollars, and you want to figure out how could you best spend that money, well, you're going to look at the two or three highest dimensions in that analysis, and you're going to try to then focus the commercial on those factors. So, you know, maybe it's female, maybe it's working class income, maybe it's high school education, whatever, you know, you're going to try to focus on those things. This is sometimes also called noise reduction, because the argument is some of these higher dimensions are very, very noisy, and you'll be better off if you simply discard them. The density function, so now we're going to try to sort of cast this in a log likelihood type scenario. The density function of a data point under the model, assuming a Gaussian model, is given by, well, we just have a multivariate Gaussian. So the probability of a feature vector X can be written as the transformation of X minus the mean times the inverse covariance matrix times that quantity in the non-transpose. So we have our typical quadratic form here. And the key thing now is we have a transformation theta, which is going to transform X, and then we have a mean in the transform space. So G sub I is simply an indicator function for the class assignment for each data point. This simply represents the density function for the transform data. Now, I should say, I'm going to just, at a very high level, go through some of the key steps in this derivation. You have a link on the main page to the dissertation that really pioneered this work and goes through the derivations in great detail. So we don't have time this semester to go through all the details. So I'm just going to try to hit the high points and explain the significance of these results, but I won't hold you to the details of this derivation because it's rather complicated. The log likelihood function, then, if we take the log of this expression, we've done this before, it's going to have the usual components. It's going to have a component associated with the quadratic term, a component associated with this constant term, and a we actually have the, since we have the ratio of two things, we can write that as the sum of two logs. So here's our likelihood function, and it's in terms of means, covariances, and the transformation matrix theta. And now we would like to differentiate this with respect to the unknown means and variances. So we now need to find these mean vectors, we need to find the transformation matrix, and we need to find the covariance. And So we can go ahead and differentiate this expression with respect to the unknowns, means, and variances. We've done a similar derivation for the maximum likelihood estimation. And if you do that in this case, you end up with an expression for the mean, which is just the transformation of the data X. So it's just essentially the transform mean. And that makes sense because we're still dealing with the usual kind of Mahalanobis distance or quadratic distance measure here. So we get the transform mean is just the mean of the transform, but we don't know yet what theta is, and the And this can actually be, since it's a linear transformation, it can be, again, separated into the mean of the components that we retain and the mean of the components that we discard. And then similarly, we can write the covariance of the dimensions that we retain in a familiar form of theta transpose times C sub J times theta, where C sub J is the covariance of the original data, and then the covariance of the data that we discard. And this, again, is not surprising because we're able to decouple essentially the dimensions that we retain and dimensions that we discard. Now, substituting those values into the likelihood equation and then maximizing with respect to theta gives us an equation which says that the optimal value of the transformation matrix is equal to the maximum of this expression with respect to theta. We have the log of the determinant of theta times the covariance times theta n minus p. So this is essentially the this is the term, this is associated with the constant term. Then we have the log, we have the sum over the classes of the log of theta times C times theta. Theta transpose times C times theta. Now, this is, in general, this is a nonlinear set of equations with respect to theta. We can see a couple things here. One is that if we assume that the variances are equal, this term essentially goes away and we're left with a maximization that's very similar to what we had in LDA. But in this case, we're assuming now that the variances are different. And therefore, what we're left with is essentially a nonlinear optimization. So, for the general case, we must solve this iteratively using a gradient descent algorithm and a two-step process in which we estimate the means and variances from theta, and then estimate the optimal value of theta from the means and variances. This two-step process we're going to study next class. This is the expectation maximization algorithm known as EM. And the derivation of HLDA depends heavily on this approach. Simplifications do exist for diagonal and equal covariances. In audio processing, where much of this work was done, we assume diagonal covariances typically in our models. And in other pattern recognition cases, we'll assume equal covariances. But the benefits of these algorithms seem to diminish when you do that. You sort of lose what's the power of the algorithm. The classification is fairly straightforward, only there's a little bit of a twist that we have to classify the data, we actually have to compute the log likelihood distance, because we have to take into account the different variances of each class. If you remember in our maximum likelihood derivation, when we had a two-class problem, we had these terms associated with the variances as well as the priors, in addition to the normal kind of Euclidean distance or quadratic term. And the same thing here. So to actually classify the data, we have to evaluate the likelihood function, and that's one of the reasons this is a little more computationally complex. So what I'll do next is to work a couple examples. But we haven't really talked about HLDA training, because to do the training, we're going to need to make use of the EM algorithm, and that we haven't talked about yet. But training is significantly more expensive because we have to use this iterative approach to solving this equation. But once you're done with training, the classification is fairly straightforward. So let's first go back to our simple case of two Gaussians. And we've worked this now with PCA. And arrived at a fairly straightforward solution. We've worked this with LDA. And arrived at a similar solution to PCA. And now we can work this with HLDA. And not surprisingly, we get the same solution. Because if the data has, for example, equal variances and it's well separated, the two will produce the same similar results. Now let's see if we can create this example that so now we have this case where we've got data that overlaps. If I classify this with PCA, how would you describe the error rate that we're going to get? Yeah, it should essentially, we should correctly classify these points and, well, let's see. Let's see what happens with PCA. So with PCA, we're going to model the data as a single covariance and in the transform space, this is what the data looks like. The means are computed and they overlap, which is not good for PCA, because for PCA we need the means to overlap. So then it just sort of draws essentially a decision surface at random, because the problem with PCA is these means overlap and it doesn't really know what to do. It can't draw a surface that's perpendicular to the line connecting the mean. So let's see what LDA does. So LDA produces a very similar result. The PCA error rate was 45.9%. The LDA error rate is 46%. So the two basically give the same solution. So let's see if this HLDA algorithm is capable of giving us a lower error rate. Yeah, so in this case, the overall error rate was about the same, which is kind of interesting. Yeah, well, I'm guessing that the 50% error rate is probably just simply the fact that about 50% of the data points fall outside this surface, the way I drew it. But we can look at the transformation matrix in the case of PCA. This is the form of the transformation matrix for this case. So we've got these large diagonal terms. Let's see what LDA came up with. So you can see, well, the transformation matrix for LDA is quite a bit different. So it's actually found, I guess if you look at this in a vector space, it's actually found a much different, well, not really. I mean, if you think of these as vectors, the orientation of the vectors is very similar. Well, and then with LDA, HLDA, you get sort of a, you get a different structure. So, not overwhelming in terms of differences in performance, but theoretically, HLDA, if you can find the parameters through the numerical optimization, will do better than, you know, slightly better than LDA or PCA. Now let's it's supposed to work that way. Now let me spend a few minutes talking about independent components analysis, and then we'll wrap up with a couple summary comments. So thus far we've looked primarily at techniques which measure mean squared error or measure variance. They're sensitive to mean squared error and variance. With HLDA, we make an attempt to relate this to maximum likelihood and likelihood type functions. But you might ask, well, can we go further in classifying this data? And the answer to that is yes, if we're willing to make some more assumptions about our data. So with independent component analysis, the goal is to discover underlying structure in a signal. This originally gained popularity for applications in blind source separation, the process of extracting one or more unknown signals from noise. When this was introduced, it was considered pretty revolutionary because, of course, there was a nice demo where they showed multiple people speaking in a room, cocktail party kind of effect, and they were able to very effectively separate out one speaker from the group based on the fact that that speaker's statistics are different than all the other statistics of all the other speakers in the room. So it's been most often applied to time series analysis, though it can actually be and has been used in recent years for traditional pattern recognition problems. As usual with this approach, we define a signal. In this case, we're going to define a signal as a sum of statistically independent signals. So for a problem like the cocktail party effect, that makes sense because you might say, well, we've got two or three talkers in the room, and I want to model each of them independently. And I want to see if this algorithm can come up with the weights of a filter that essentially allow me to model the overall signal as the weighted sum of these three individual signals. So if we can estimate A, then we can compute S by inverting A. And this is what's often called the blind deconvolution problem. You develop a model, you estimate the parameters of the model, then you invert the model, and that allows you then to get back to the source and to essentially remove the channel. So in the case of the multiple speaker problem, once you do this, you're then able to recover each of the individual talkers separately. In the case of room reverberation, you might want to recover my speech. As you're recording my speech in this room, you're getting all this reverberation. You might like to model that somehow and then invert that filter and be able to remove the reverberation from my voice, from my recorded voice. Now, the unique aspect of ICA is that it attempts to model X as a sum of statistically independent non-Gaussian signals. And that was rather remarkable that that was sort of one of the first applications. I don't know why the animations are all messed up. So unlike the mean squared error approach, however, ICA attempts to optimize the parameters of the model based on a variety of information theoretic measures. The measure that was first introduced was mutual information, and that was really why people got excited about this, because the thought of, rather than using something like mean squared error, let's try to use mutual information as a criterion to do this pattern recognition. So you might think, for example, of minimizing mutual information between the classes you're trying to recognize. That makes them as separated as possible in an information theory sense or in an information space. There are a couple variants of this, something called the negative entropy, and there's a maximum likelihood variant. And there's some relationship between mutual information and negative entropy. We won't go into those today, but as you look through the literature, you'll see these are the most popular objective functions that people are using in conjunction with ICA. It is common in ICA to zero mean and pre-whiten the data using PCA so that the technique can focus on the non-Gaussian aspects of the data. Since these are linear operators, they do not impact the non-Gaussian aspects of the model. So it's ICA is often used as a post-processing step to a principal components analysis. Now, there are no closed-form solutions for the problem described above, and a gradient descent approach must be used to find the model parameters. And to completely understand this, we will again need to invoke the expectation maximization algorithm. So we can't really describe too much of the detail today, but I'll sort of sketch out one example of So let me show you an example of something called fast ICA, which is a little easier to explain and it gives you a flavor of the algorithm. So one very popular approach for ICA is based on a projection of X that maximizes non-Gaussianity. And this is an approximation to this negative entropy is used in terms of the expectations of the Gaussians of essentially the data that you're trying to find, trying to separate. And an iterative equation solver is used for finding the best weight for your weight vector. So what's done is to essentially take a random guess for W, compute a new W, which is based on the expectation of X times this G function of X transpose W minus the expectation of G prime, where G prime can, for example, represent the existing model and G can represent the new model. And if the direction of this changes, we essentially take this W and normalize it. And then if the direction of W changes, we iterate. So this is an iterative approach where you're essentially guessing W, looking at a term. This term relates to the derivative of the objective function, but we don't really go into that today. And then based on the sign of this derivative, you adjust your coefficients and you go back and repeat. And this algorithm has been used with ICA. We'll see later in the course that this kind of iteration based on the derivative, we'll sort of generalize this and introduce this as a direct parameter estimation algorithm of almost any nonlinear objective function. And I don't expect you to understand the details of this since we really skipped this, but the idea is simply that you are somehow able to find an iterative solution to optimizing this function in terms of the W's. FastICA is very similar to a gradient descent solution of the maximum likelihood equation, and it's been successfully applied to a number of problems such as blind source separation for audio, EEG signals, and actually financial data as well. All these algorithms, the neat thing about all these algorithms is they all do essentially the same thing. They come up with this vector W, the transformation vector. But what they differ in is the way the assumptions that they make or the objective function that they optimize. With PCA, we model variance. With LDA, we model discrimination. With HLDA, we model discrimination without requiring the variances of the classes to be equal. With ICA, we actually look at the mutual information of the classes. So there's a whole family of these kinds of algorithms. There are actually algorithms based on neural network type concepts where you use a neural network to find the transformation matrix. And, there's a lot of different variants of these kinds of algorithms, and they all simply make different assumptions about the data, whether you're modeling its statistical properties, its mean squared error, its variances. So again, I wanted to introduce a few of these algorithms to let you appreciate something we've talked about now a bit through this course, is that there's no right or wrong algorithm. You saw an example, for example, where HLDA was not much better than LDA and PCA. It all comes down to how well the assumptions of these algorithms actually match the problem that you're trying to solve. And then the final question is, for the same number of parameters, W, which algorithm gives you the better performance? And very often what you find is that if the assumptions of your algorithm don't really match your problem, there's not much difference between any of these algorithms for the same number of parameters. Now, it's really important when you compare algorithms to make sure that you're comparing them with the same number of parameters. I cannot tell you the number of times I see someone say, my new algorithm is better, but it's using twice the parameters. And with any kind of iterative algorithm, you would expect the more parameters you use, the better performance you're going to get. But ultimately, it comes down to the assumptions implied by the algorithm about the data. And with, for example, ICA, you're operating on the mutual information of the classes, not the mean squared error. And whether or not that's appropriate to your problem remains to be seen. Now, let me go back to the to this little example here. So you might ask the question, if your data is distributed like this, how can we do pattern recognition on it? Well, we talked at the beginning of the semester about the fact that we can condition the features on other information to separate out classes like this when there's such overlap. So HLDA is actually used in speech recognition systems today. Even though you might say on a pure feature vector classification problem, it doesn't give much difference in performance. When you combine it with the other things we do in a speech recognition system, which is use context to separate this overlap, then you actually start to see some improvement with HLDA. It is a very minor improvement, but enough that people have adopted it as their standard feature vector approach. But you will only see that in the context of a speech recognition problem. If you just look at classification of the features themselves without all the speech recognition stuff, you won't see much difference in performance. Now, that's a subtle point, but it's a point I want to make sure you understand. Even though there's overlap in the feature space, your ultimate pattern recognition system may be using a lot of different information. And in that case, it may actually make more sense to use something like HLDA. But the only way you'll ever learn that is to run the experiment. If you just try to do the classification of the features in isolation, you may not see much difference in performance. Okay, so that's a little bit on things beyond PCA and LDA. ICA is actually covered in the textbook in Chapter 10, so I listed that in your reading. But we won't, you know, it's a topic into itself, so we won't really go much into detail on it. What I will talk about next time, though, is an important topic, which is the EM algorithm. And that's one of the core concepts I hope you'll take away from the class this semester. Okay.